Good morning, everyone. My name is Annalisa Lukes. I'm the vice chair of this board. Thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate your time for this special meeting. Our goal and intention today is to get through our 1 hour together and vote on the five action items that are on the agenda. And so we'll go ahead and get started chairing this meeting in the absence of Terry Hollingsworth, and look forward to getting through our meeting together. So let's go ahead and get started with the Pledge of Allegiance. Do we have a flag that we can flash on the screen? Thank you. All right, let's go ahead and begin. I pledge allegiance,
To the flag of the United States of America
and to the republic
for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so much. And just as a note, we are recording this session, and let's go ahead and have a board member roll call. Marissa?
Okay. Gloria Alvarado?
Present.
Natalie Alvarez?
Present.
Jesse Benron? Rob Claudio? Eric Cadornis, David Hahn, Lore Holland Lace,
here,
Terry Hollingsworth, Trung Lee, John Luker,
here,
Annalisa Lukes,
present,
Trung Lee here, sorry, I was on mute,
thank you, and Doug Mangione,
here.
Barbara Mason.
Here.
Gary Matkin.
Here.
Ernesto Medrano. Carlos Organ. Mike Ruane. Todd Sword.
Here.
And Brenyel Tumor Bias.
Here.
And we do have quorum.
Thank you so much, Carissa. And at this time, I'll ask staff if we receive any public comment or if there are any comments from our guests. Now would be the time to come forward.
And if you're calling in and you're a guest, you can hit *9 if you would like to raise your hand to speak.
Thank you, Carissa.
We did not receive any speaker requests either. So it doesn't appear that anyone would like to speak.
Okay, well, hearing none, let's go ahead and move on to the action items. And for each of these items, I will ask Karma Lacey to give a brief overview before we open it for discussion and call it for a vote. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to, we're at item 5, policies and procedures, point heading 1, one-stop code of conduct policy. Karma?
Good morning. So recently we've seen a lot of challenges in the one-stop center where the safety for not only the staff in the one-stop center and the partners, but some of the patrons have been challenged, meaning there have been some acts of violence or areas of harassment, which led us to creating a code of conduct policy. The code of conduct policy basically outlines what the expectations are in the one-stop facilities or any of our training facilities for patrons and also staff, and what our process will be in the event that anyone violates that. This policy is presented in front of this board for review and approval, and then it will be taken up to the Orange County Board of Supervisors for final vote and approval, and will be adopted in all of our facilities. Are there any questions or concerns about this policy?
This is Rob. On the code of conduct, the policy number 20, I think it references that the internet is not to be utilized for job, like it mentions all media.
Right, so we've had some challenges with people using our resource room to go look at YouTube videos or things that are not appropriate.
My point is though, the EDD has a channel to instruct customers on how to use the, you know, on the different benefit programs for unemployment insurance or disability insurance.
That's not what we're getting at. We're talking about people using our facilities to look at things that are inappropriate. So using our facilities or our free resource room to look at things that are not related to job search. So for example, watch movies. That's not what the purpose of the one-stop resource room is for. I'm just giving you an example. We can add a line in here to say that, what it does say, let me find the line. It says, the internet is to be utilized for job searching purposes only. All media, including but not limited to videos, chat, games, YouTube, Facebook, are prohibited from the one-stop center owned computers and devices. So we can add a line to that because the first sentence says it's utilized for job search purposes only. So I feel like we're being very clear that if you're using it to look for a job, fine. But what we don't want you to do is use it for catching up on a series of...
I completely get that. But the prohibited of YouTube, I don't know. I kind of wrote what I just wrote to myself. Maybe it should say something. In regards to instructional videos on accessing benefit information from EDD.
So what I can do is add a line that says, so we have that using technology and computers, phones. So what we can do is it's prohibited unless it is used for instructional purposes. I can add a line that says that.
Yeah, because I think some of the customers that do come into the one-stop they may have issues with accessing benefits, whether it's unemployment or disability, they may refer to them.
Okay.
But no, all the other stuff I am in completely agreement with.
So I'm gonna add behind prohibited, unless it is used for education or workforce instructional purposes. Okay, so we'll add that to that.
Okay.
Any other questions or concerns about this policy?
We have a chat message from Trung Lei to all panelists. I agree with Rob regarding the use of YouTube as there are instructional videos on resume. Okay. I do have a question, Karma, and thank you for providing the background around the need for the code of conduct. With regard to those facts, I'm curious to know how it got resolved, and more importantly, is there any exposure for the board as a result of whatever might have transpired?
So prior to me, I'll just be honest, prior to me coming here, it is my understanding that the one-stop created a banned policy. They were banning people from the one-stop center. You can't really ban anyone from the facility unless you give them the rules and basically outline here are the procedures in the event that you break these rules. The one-stop center didn't actually have that, so you can't actually ban anyone from this facility. So when I recently learned that there were people who'd been banned from the one-stop center, I questioned how can you ban them without a code of conduct policy, and which as a result created this policy. So I think that it was past practice that there were people that were asked never to return, and you can't really do that if you don't outline here is what the expectations are for you if you use our facility. So that's where this came from.
Okay, that's helpful. Are there any other questions or comments before we ask for a motion?
I have a clarifying question in the event. Forgive me if I've missed this. Do we need to have any COVID sensitive measures in this code of conduct, or are there just more localized measures and standards of conduct that are already made clear through visiting those centers?
Yes, yeah, so the COVID standards are one thing. And so those standards are already in place. We already have a COVID or actually a policy that includes emergencies and COVID in that policy and the procedure. So this policy, I don't think that it's necessary to put COVID in there. However, if you believe that we need to put something in there, we can, but I thought they were two different things. So code of conduct is how you're supposed to act when you're in the center. The COVID is for a current event and part of the emergency process and standards for the workforce centers and programs.
Awesome, thank you.
Okay. All right, I'll go ahead and ask for a motion to approve the one.
Actually, I had a quick question.
Yes, go ahead, Todd.
Are we asking people, Karma, to sign a form that they agree with this code of conduct? So we'll have that on file.
will. So what will happen is this will go in front of the Board of Supervisors. Once the Board of Supervisors agrees to this, this will be a part of the enrollment packet and posted in the one-stop centers and all the other facilities.
Got it. Perfect. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, hearing none, I'll go ahead and ask that someone make a motion to approve the policy regarding the one-stop code of conduct.
I'll move, Doug Mangione.
I'll second.
Are we voting by raised hands, or is it going to be a roll call vote?
Krista will need to do a roll call vote.
Okay.
We're going to pull the board. Sorry, so who was the second? Was that David?
Yeah, I can second.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
All right, we'll go ahead and call it up to a vote, and Carissa will pull the members.
Yes. Gloria Alvarado? Natalie Alvarez?
Aye.
Jeff. Rob Claudio? Rob, you can say if you're for or against it.
I said aye.
Eric.
Thank you. Eric Cadornis?
Aye.
David Hahn?
Aye.
Jorge Helen Leaves?
Aye.
Trungley?
Aye.
John Luker?
Aye.
Annalisa Lukes?
Aye.
Doug Mangione?
Aye.
Barbara Mason? Gary Matkin?
Aye.
Todd Sword?
Aye.
And Brenial Tumor Bias?
Aye.
Okay. And motion carries.
Okay. Motion carries unanimously, it sounds like. Okay. Awesome. Thank you. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to item 5B, WIOA, Individual Initial Assessment and Individual Employment Plan Policy. Let's go ahead and give a brief overview, Karma.
So a part of WIOA requires that when we enroll a participant in our program, we assess their education and functioning levels, as well as create an employment plan for them. This policy identifies what assessments are appropriate for service providers, so we're consistent across our programs and what we're using. It also identifies and outlines for the service providers what procedures need to be followed to properly conduct an employment plan. We've had an education employment, or excuse me, an assessment process in the past that allowed service providers to kind of pick the assessment, but the assessments didn't necessarily follow the federal and state mandates, so they weren't always in alignment. In addition to that, we've always had an education plan. However, what we realize is that the education plans that we've seen more recently were all kind of the same plan. They weren't actually individualized for that person. We weren't meeting that person and treating them like an individual and figuring out their particular needs. We were pretty much grouping people together and saying that everybody will have this pathway, meaning that if we enrolled 10 people in the one-stop center, all 10 people would have had the same experience because we weren't looking at them as individuals. So this policy really highlights to service providers what our expectations are and meeting people where they are and creating plans that are truly for that individual and actually unique and not just herding people through a program. So in the law, it's required to have an individual plan for each participant. And so this policy helps us to be in alignment with the law and the expectations on the federal and state level. And this, there's a difference between this one and the next one. This one is specifically for adults and dislocated workers.
Okay. Thank you for that overview. At this time, I would like to ask if anyone on the board has any questions or anyone else on the call has questions regarding this policy.
So this is Eric Cordney's just question about the plan and the standard as nature of the plan. Does that impact the vendors, right, from creating or using certain aspects of what may be out there in the community that might limit their ability to create individual plans? I mean, we're creating something standardized, and yet we're telling them that we need something to be individualized for the for the person that's taking the test. So I'm just trying to make sure that we're not creating something that's going to prohibit them or limit their ability to create more individualized services.
So let me break this into two parts. When I talk about the assessments and identify what assessments are allowable, these are assessments that have been vetted by the federal government and the state. So in the past, service providers were choosing assessments that were not education and function level assessments. They were using career, career assessments. So for example, they were assessments to say, it may be a 20 question thing that says, oh, you might be prompt or you might be more likely to be successful as a nurse. That is not an education and function level assessment. That's a career aptitude test. And so we need to identify the difference between an education function level test to figure out where you are in terms of reading and math versus what career pathway you're interested in. So that's one reason this is necessary, because the other part of the problem with this is that when they take them down these assessments that were career functioning or career aptitude assessments, they weren't recognized by the state, which made us not compliant. So if you use a career guide assessment and you put it as somebody, if you put it in the system as how you develop your educational plan or your employment plan, the state basically dinged us because that's not an approved one and that's not what an education function level assessment is. So this policy identifies what's allowable under the federal and state law for a function level test. And then it identifies that you've taken someone through the pathway of determining their actual plan and not hurting people through a program. So I understand your concern about limiting a service providers, but in some respect, you kind of have to guide them on what's allowable and what's not, and making sure that they're not hurting people through a program and actually meeting people where they are.
Yeah, I think you answered it perfectly in the sense that separating out the education versus the maybe job placement aptitude. Right. Exactly what I was thinking of. So I appreciate that there is a difference in level of education and how do we educate somebody and give them a path for that versus the career aptitude, two different things. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
I have a question. This is Trung.
Yes, Trung.
So Karma, our counselor who are stationed at the One Stop Center, every consumer client, if you will, goes through our program. We were writing what we call an individualized plan for employment. Does, in addition to what we're drafting for the consumer, are you asking that we drafting a separate one for the purpose of the One Stop? Or I'm not clear on that.
This is for WIOA participants. So I'm not asking you as a partner in the One Stop Center to change your program design. This is a policy for anyone enrolled in WIOA, because as you know, Trangley, when you enroll in WIOA, mm-hmm. we have to do an application and then we have to do an assessment and then we have to do an IEP in WIOA. So this is for our service providers enrolling participants in WIOA, what our expectations are in terms of the assessment to be used and the individual employment plan that they should be using for participants enrolled.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Karma, mm-hmm. This is Annalisa. I've got a question regarding the policy. It sounds like we're really continuing to do what we can to be in compliance or remedy certain things. But with regard to the new policy, will this require any substantial training as it relates to the service providers, or is this something that they'll be able to pick up and put into action?
That's a great question. So WIOA has been enacted since 2014. This is something that should already be doing and something that they should be able to quickly put into action, in my opinion, because this is what we should have been doing since 2014. If training is required, my staff and I are willing to provide the service providers technical assistance to help them with this. Part of our role of all policy is to sit down with the service providers team and go through the policy page by page and answer any questions that they have. So that if there are challenges with this, we identify that and work with them to help them overcome those challenges. So I don't foresee there being any, but if there are, we're here to provide technical assistance.
Thank you for that. Are there any other questions,
So just, sorry, this is Eric Courtney's again. So just to clarify, on page 14, where it has the individual employment plan, and I think even where I was confused is we talk so much about the employment plan and there's such a focus there, but this is really the education component of it. So I just, can you just clarify again, this kind of employment plan that they're signing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there are two parts to this. So remember, when you enroll someone in WIOA, you do an application and assessment. So this is tackling the assessment part, and then you develop an employment plan for them. So this is both. This is what assessment you use to develop the employment plan. Every participant is required to have an employment plan when you're enrolled in WIOA.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Hearing none, I'd like to ask for a vote on WIOA individual initial assessment and individual employment plan policy. Sorry, I'd like to call ask for a motion, pardon me.
I'll make a motion, Consort.
Thank you. Second?
I'll second, Doug Mangione.
Thank you, Doug. All right, and we'll take it to Carissa so that we can poll the board members for the vote.
Thank you. Gloria Alvarado?
Yes.
Natalie Alvarez?
Aye.
Rob Claudio?
Aye.
Eric Cordonese?
Aye.
David Hahn?
Aye.
Lorae Hollenleis?
Aye.
Trung Lee?
Aye.
John Luker?
Aye.
Annalisa Lukes?
Aye.
Doug Mangione?
Aye.
Barbara Mason? Gary Matkin?
Aye.
Ernesto Medrano? Mike Ruane?
Aye.
Todd Sword?
Aye.
And Brynjal Tumor Bias.
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries.
Unanimously.
Thank you so much. Carissa?
Yes. Oh, Jesse.
Sorry, this is Jesse. Yeah. So I'm here. So I know I came late. So I mean, but just moving forward, I am present.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. No, thank you.
All right. So let's go ahead and move on to item 5C on the agenda, WIOA Youth Initial Assessment and Individual Service Plan ISP Policy. Brief overview from Carmen.
Okay, so just like the other plan, under the youth, it's called something different though. So the adult IEP is the individual employment plan for adults and dislocated workers. For youth, it's called the individual service plan. Similar challenges. So what this policy is established to do is to define what assessments are expected for service providers to use to rate or to assess an individual's education function level, a youth's education function level. And then the other part of this policy is to develop their service plan strategy. So remember, under the youth program, there are four potential placements. So the number one placement is post-secondary education. Number two is unsubsidized employment. Number three is military. And then the final one is apprenticeship or trade placement. That is the goal for a youth program. So unlike the adult program is designed to help the adults and dislocated workers with employment placement. The youth program is one of those four. So that's why it's not a employment plan, it's a service plan to help a youth get connected to one of those four outcomes. So the same thing with this policy, it's required by law, both federal and state have directives and laws related to the individual service strategy for youth. The youth are required to be exposed to all 14 program elements. This policy identifies for service providers what our expectations are in terms of meeting a youth where they are instead of hurting them through a program, what assessments need to be used to identify their functioning levels, and then basically identifying which service strategy that you are going to implement to help youth get to one of those four outcomes.
Thank you for that. At this time, I'd like to ask if there are any questions, comments, or feedback.
This is Trang Lai. Karma, can you give some the name of some of the service providers?
We only have one, well, technically two service providers right now. So we have City of La Habra, which is our main service providers for youth programs. And then mm-hmm. we have Goodwill, who's providing a program called STEPS that focuses on youth with disabilities. So those are the two youth service providers currently.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. Karma, it's Annalisa again. I remember from at least the last board meeting that there were challenges with regards to numbers, particularly as it relates to youth. And I'm not asking you to speculate or predict the future, but do you think that having this policy will help increase those numbers, or do you think it'll...
This policy has nothing to do with numbers. This policy is basically what happens when you enroll youth in the program. This will not change the numbers.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, or feedback? Okay, hearing none, I'd like to ask for a motion to approve the WIOA Youth Initial Assessment and Individual Service Plan policy. Would anybody like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion. This is Trang Lai.
Thank you, Trang.
Awesome. Gloria, second.
And I'll go down the roll, starting with Gloria.
Yes.
Natalie Alvarez.
Aye.
Jesse Benron.
Aye.
Rob Claudio.
Aye.
Eric Dornis.
Aye.
David Hahn.
Aye.
Laurie Holland-Lease.
Aye.
Trung Lee.
Aye.
John Luker.
Aye.
Annalisa Lukes. Doug Mangione.
Aye.
Barbara Mason. Gary Matkin.
Aye.
Mike Ruane.
Aye.
Todd Sword.
Aye.
Brenyel Tumor-Bias.
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you, Carissa. Thank you, everyone. Now we're going to move on to action item 6 on the agenda, OC Regional and Unified Local Plans Program Years 2021 to 24. You all received a draft of this, so let's go ahead and have a brief overview, Karma.
So I'll start with the regional plan. As you know, under the federal law, we are required to operate as a region. So we have our own local workforce area, but then we are required to create regional programs designed to support the workforce system regionally. The state of California identified Santa Ana, Anaheim, and Orange County as a region. So together we are supposed to implement regional activities. In addition to our partnership with the two other workforce boards, we are also required to partner with community providers and various organizations throughout Orange County to create regional plans and local plans. So with that said, every 2 years, the state of California requires that we submit a regional and local plan. The regional local plan is written in partnership with feedback or input from all three workforce boards, but also community partners. So as you know, our regional advisor, Annette Riddles, has conducted several regional sessions with different stakeholders throughout the community to obtain input from them about just our regional strategy and local strategy and how we move forward as a workforce region. So as a result of the community engagement that Annette had, both Annette and Aaron drafted a regional and local plan. The reason why this is being presented in front of you today is that the Workforce Development Board, so Santa Ana, Anaheim, and our board, must all vote on accepting a regional and local plan, and it has to be submitted to the Board of Supervisors for final approval and then submitted to the state. The challenge is that the regional and local plans are technically due in April. In order for me to get it in front of the Board of Supervisors, it needs to go through our board, Santa Ana's and Anaheim's, which are all, they're all presenting this information in front of those boards and submit it to the state for to be signed. However, there's a period of public comment. So today I'm asking that this board basically votes on accepting the regional and local plans with with non-substantiated or non-substantial changes, because we also have to have a 30-day public comment period, which is now. So we don't have all the public comments or information input in this plan. However, in order for us to move forward and meet the deadlines, we need to present this information and our draft of this plan to the board for review and approval so that we can get it through the proper channels to submit to the state. I think that's probably high level the easiest way to explain it to you guys, but then I'm willing to answer any questions you have about what's written in these plans. Questions?
Any questions, comments, or feedback? What point in April is this due?
Annette, I apologize. Annette, can you chime in on the due date?
It is due on April the 30th to the state. It does not have to be signed at that point, but then we would get signatures in by June 30th.
And so I'm going to chime in. So in order for it to be on a Board of Supervisors agenda before June, we have to have it submitted by March 8th in order to be heard by the May 11th board date. We're trying to push for that date and have May 25th, which is the next board meeting after that, as our backup so that we don't miss the deadline. So we're trying to present it, put it on the agenda now for May 11th. So we have to get it submitted by March 8th to be on the May 11th agenda. And if all goes well, it'll be voted on that day, but we have May 25th as our backup date. So that's why we've called a special meeting for it to be heard now so that we can meet the deadlines.
And just to be clear, there has been 30 days or there has not been 30 days of public comment?
Currently open it with a 30-day public comment. Annette, can you confirm with the start of the 30 days?
We are working on getting the website up, and so the goal is to actually get that posted today and be open for the 30 days from today.
Okay, and besides having the website, are we going to send an email or something, a notification to the community to invite them to comment publicly?
Yes, so it will be on the website. We will send it out to the OC Leadership Council will be posted on all three boards' websites. It will go out to social media sites for each of the boards and just to the chambers. All the same individuals that we kind of notified from the very beginning, everyone who attended the actual community stakeholder meetings will receive it by email. So we will be distributing it as widely as we possibly can through the online media.
Annette, can you also share with them the dates that it will be presented in front of the Santa Ana and Anaheim Workforce Board so they understand that the process is not, that we're doing is not different from what they have to do as well?
So it will go before the, let's look at the dates here. One second. Pull
that up. So just while she's looking that up, so for Santa Ana, it'll go in front of the Santa Ana Workforce Board and then their city council. And then the same thing for Anaheim. It'll go in front of the Anaheim Workforce Development Board and their city council. So very similar process to what we have to do. So it goes in front of our workforce board and then the Board of Supervisors. But the Board of Supervisors will not approve this until it's heard by all of the stakeholders, meaning that both Santa Ana and Anaheim's workforce boards and their city council.
So it will go before Santa Ana's Workforce Development Board on March the 18th. Anaheim's Workforce Development Board is April 21st. And then it will go before City Council for Santa Ana, April 20th, and Anaheim City Council, April 27th.
Can you clarify for us, you know, opening up the public comments, the kind of feedback that we might get back. I imagine the goal of opening up the public comments is that there's some concern. Can you just clarify the value of that? And is there any recourse to make adjustments? And is that what the non-substantive adjustments are for?
Sure. Yes, correct. So we are required by the state to have a public comment period. So We really don't have an option. I can tell you in my experience, just with multiple boards in multiple areas, typically we really don't get any responses. And if I have ever gotten responses, it's only been a couple and nothing major. If I look at even the last plan that you guys did on the 2-year modification and the full 4-year plan, neither one of those had any public comments. No one submitted any comments.
Okay, thank you. I just had one quick question regarding logistics. I think I read on page 17 of the plan that there are intentions to relaunch meetings again. If so, what is the timeline for that in light of COVID, and how would we go about doing that?
So a lot of the feedback was to, we're still doing like our OC leadership meeting. We're doing that online. But there were meetings that were happening between, for instance, Orange County Social Services, that were between the frontline staff and those organizations. And so those were the meetings that we're going to try and get back going virtually, initially. And it's basically now that the plan is written, we are going to kind of move forward and start really trying to execute what we said we were going to do. And then just, I've been going through and looking at all the comments, listening to the Zoom meetings. Not, we will also be posting the Zoom meetings, just so you know, if anyone wants to look at that, they will be on the website as well. But I've gone through those meetings and just kind of outlined exactly what we said we're going to do, and we will start executing on everything immediately.
I want to chime in an example. So last year, with a modification, Orange County Child Support Enforcement Agency started having conversations with us about how to connect individuals who were behind on their child support to the workforce center, and essentially forgiving them or lifting judgments that were made against them for not paying child support if they engage with the one-stop system. We were well down the road in creating a pathway to basically document or demonstrate that individual is using our system so that they can eliminate the driver's license restriction that were on those individuals that were behind in child support. We were well on our way with creating a whole pathway for that, and then COVID happened, so those conversations stopped. So this is what Annette is sharing as an example of what happened and how we're going to resume those conversations so that we can continue to expand program delivery so that we are meeting our stakeholders where they are, and also providing support to these organizations that want to partner with us in our workforce system to help their clients.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments?
I had a question. This is Todd. What kind of activities have you planned with Santa Ana and Anaheim Workforce Boards? Have you guys already kind of aligned some plans to, you know, implement on this? And can you comment on that?
Yeah, so picking back up that conversation with child support, we also had an email invitation from SSA saying that, hey, we want to start talking about how do we connect our participants to your programs. So both Santa Ana and Anaheim and our workforce board are engaging in conversations monthly on basically how do we continue to strengthen regional work, grants and opportunities that we need to apply for together, policies that need to be written together as a workforce region, and then how do we strengthen partnerships. So we do have, like Annette said, we still have the OC region meetings. We've continued those the entire time. We have those every other month. We also do the planning for those meetings and what we plan to share with workforce partners. And when we say partners, we've got about 60 organizations that are part of that region. So we are very much partnering and actually doing activity together as a region.
That's great. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? All right, hearing none, we would like to open it up, and I'd like somebody to make a motion to approve.
Motion to approve. This is Rob.
Thank you. Second. Second, it's Mike.
Thank you. And Carissa, let's go ahead and pull the board.
Gloria Alvarado?
Yes.
Natalie Alvarez?
Aye.
Jesse Benrong?
Aye.
Rob Claudio?
Aye.
Eric Cordonese?
Aye.
David Hahn?
Aye.
Lorraine Holland Lace?
Aye.
Trung Lee?
Aye.
John Luker?
Aye.
Annalisa Lukes?
Aye.
Doug Mangione?
Aye.
Barbara Mason? Gary Matkin?
Aye.
Mike Ruane? Todd Sword?
Aye.
Aye.
And Brineal Tumor Bias?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Carissa. Okay, we're going to move on to the last item on the agenda. Item 7, fiscal year 2021-2022 YOA program funding. Let's go ahead and give a brief overview, Karma.
Okay, so this is a tough conversation. So I'll try to pick it apart as best as I can. So every year we get a funding notice of how much money we're going to get for the next year. Here's our problem. The year starts on July 1st. So this next funding year for program 2021-22 starts July 1st, and technically the funding ends on, so it's July 1st, 2021, and ends on June 30th, 2023. That's how the money works. So the money is given to you for a particular program year, but it's good for technically 2 years, okay? So I'm gonna start there. Every year, EDD is required to give us a notice of funding award. Here's the problem. There's no consistency when we get the notice. So for example, as of today, I have absolutely no idea how much money we're gonna get next year. I have my thoughts about it because we're in the middle of recession that we'll get probably more than we received in the past years, but I don't know exactly how much money we're gonna get. Now here's my dilemma. In order for me to approve contracts for next year, our service provider's contracts are written from July 1 through June 30th. In order for me to approve contracts for the next year, I kind of have to know how much money we're gonna have. I don't. The other part of the problem is that in order for the Board of Supervisors to approve the contracts, remember, I now have to go in front of them now, March 8th, in order for it to be heard on the May 11th agenda or the May 25th agenda. We don't present things in June because June is the board's budget. And so a lot of things get pushed back or not heard. So that's why it's important that I present all of our stuff in May. So I wanna kind of break down the logic behind all of this. With that said, I know that we've had some conversations about service providers' performance and funding and so forth, and I know that it is a concern for the board. We have two other challenges. If you decided as a board that you don't like where these service providers are performing, we do have the ability to not award. However, you have to go to a service provider that participated in the RFP process, meaning that you'll have to go to somebody else that was a part of the RFP that maybe didn't get funded and award that particular organization. That makes sense. I just want to make sure you guys are following me. So the last time we've done a procurement for the one-stop operator, we just did that. And we've got America Works and we've got it open for a two-year renewal period, right? For the Title I career services, we did that before I got here. So that was done in, I believe, 2018. So you've got yet another year on that one before you can go out and put out another procurement. And we don't have anybody in the pipeline that's approved to provide Title I career services, right? And then for the WIOA youth program, we just completed an RFP for that one, which La Habra was selected. So these are the service providers that we have under the procurements that we put out. I will definitely work with this board to determine whether or not our procurements need to be pay for performance or cost reimbursement in the future. But if we want to get new providers, we're going to have to put out new RFPs. So I just want to be very transparent about what our reality is. So in order for me to renew contracts, I need to present to you our budget plan. So even though we don't know the dollar amount, I have to have a plan for us as a workforce area of how the money will be divvied up. So what I did, and I think I mentioned this last year when we reviewed this, I talked to the state about kind of our overall strategy that no less than 75% of our money for formula funds will go directly to serving people. And then that 10% can be set aside for administrative costs. And then about 15% can be set aside for direct direct program employee costs. So when you look at this this program plan that I'm, the resolution that I'm presenting to you, this is our workforce strategy and making sure that our contracts and service providers have some sort of guidance in terms of how the money should be provided to them. This doesn't tackle performance, but it does tackle the funding. So what I'm presenting to you today, and I'll go through, I'm sure you guys have read it, I'll go through certain parts of it. So we're saying that, I told you the structure is that no less than 15% of our job dislocated worker and youth formula funds will be spent on direct program staff costs, 75% will be spent on directly serving participants, 10% for administrative costs. Then under that, we also put in our structure that 30% of the WEAL adult dislocated worker should be spent on, and youth funds should be spent on direct training. So that means that of that 75%, 30% of that needs to be spent on training. So we no longer want to see service providers not actually having training plans for people. So that IEP and ISP, that kind of, that goes into effect, or that correlates with that, let's say that. So then we are also saying that no less than 10% for transitional jobs for adults and dislocated workers. So of that 75% that we're giving the service providers, 10% of that money needs to be spent on transitional jobs for adults and dislocated workers. Of that 75%, no less than 10% for the adult and dislocated worker funds can be spent towards upskilling, meaning that for participants who have jobs but are underpaid, we spend no less than 10% of our money towards upskilling them. The next page, where we talk about youth programs, we are saying that no less than 25% of the money provided to the youth provider must be spent on in-school youth. 75% of the funds that we give a service provider must be spent on out-of-school youth. And then 30% of all of the money spent on youth programs must be spent on youth work experience. Now, when I get to rapid response and layup aversion, those funds are in-house. So at the last time we did the financial overview, we talked about how in the past we used to give the service providers the money to provide rapid response for businesses and layup aversion funding for businesses, and it wasn't necessarily getting to businesses the way we intended. So that is why we brought business services in-house. So what we're saying for this is the same thing, that no more than or no less than 15% can be spent on my staff's cost for providing business services, 75% of the rapid response and layup aversion funds will be spent on directly supporting businesses, and then 10% can be spent on our administrative costs. Same thing for the National Dislocated Worker Grants, 75% of the money that we get from any of those dislocated worker awards must be spent on serving participants, so directly in support of participants. And then we've also said that if we receive any special grant funding, no less than 75% of any special grant that we receive must be spent on direct participant costs. Then the next section is Orange County regional grants. Because we receive regional grants that as a region, Santa Ana and Anaheim are part of our region, we serve as the fiscal overseers of that region. So the money comes to Orange County Workforce Development Board, and we then pass money down to Santa Ana and Anaheim's Workforce Board to do regional work. So this basically identifies that is our structure. Then we get down to the Orange County special projects. So these are non-WEOA funds. So whenever we receive a grant that is non-WEOA funds, this is our methodology that, again, 75% is direct program costs, 15% is for direct staff costs, and then 10% for admin costs. That is the structure that I'm asking us to approve because we don't know the dollar amounts. As you know, my team will go after grants, but I want to make sure that as we go after grants, that you're aware of our strategy on how we'll make sure that people are being served and where the money is being directed, even though we have no idea how much will happen in program year 2022. Okay, that's my crash course on it.
So this is basically requesting approval for the formula, the structure, regardless of the funding, right?
Correct. Now, keep in mind, the Board of Supervisors has to approve us receiving any money. So every year I'm required to submit a grant matrix to the Board of Supervisors that says, here's how much money we're going to try to go after this year. Here's how we're going to try to spend it. So I am required to submit that to the Orange County Board of Supervisors. And before a contract, depending on the dollar amount of the contract, I must present all contracts to the Board of Supervisors.
And as you present this formula to the service providers, it's not anything that's binding the board or the department right now to say you definitely will get the RFP, because as I heard you say, Title I may need to go out to the marketplace.
We could, if the board decides that they want to re-procure.
Are there any questions or comments?
This is Jesse. I have a couple questions. And I mean, one, Karma, essentially, what has been the criteria then? I mean, we have reported to the board on the metrics. So this is just a codification of those metrics?
No, this is strictly funding. So when we talk about metrics, we have to separate the two. So there's the performance part of it, right? And then there is the money part of it.
Wouldn't that go into how they're going to, so actually, like, if we, what were they doing prior before we notify them of how they should be spending the money? They just had carte blanche and ability to spend the $1 million they gave them however they saw fit. And so this is saying, no, 75% of that million has to go to this and 10% of that million has to go to that, right? So then what was happening before with our service providers without this guidance?
Okay, so this isn't necessarily for our service providers, this is me. So for example, if I receive, attached in your agenda are some examples of previous funding awards, right? So I gave you a copy of the directive from the 2021 award, right? And then that 2021 award, it told you that our workforce area received $8 million. And it gave you the breakdown of our $8 million. I'm basically saying to you, of that $8 million that we received, here's how I plan to divvy it up.
Okay.
And you're using percentages because we don't exactly know what the numbers are going to be.
That's exactly right.
But there's some accountability. Yes. Whatever the numbers are, this is how they should be spent.
Exactly. So this is, Jesse, this is not necessarily for our providers. This is more about when I receive the money, how I'm going to break it down. Now, it does come into effect with the service providers eventually when I do get the money, of how I negotiate those contracts. And when I negotiate those contracts, I am taking into consideration the performance that they've done and their ability to spend existing money with us. So for example, I wouldn't go into a contract with our service providers next year for nearly as much money as we've given them this year.
Okay, great. Right. Wonderful. And then my second question again, so what is the process then for us to send out RFPs? That's gonna have to go to the full board to vote, or do we have to make that decision today before it goes to the Board of Supervisors?
Well, no. So the Board of Supervisors kind of make the decision about our RFPs. So we as a workforce board can make a recommendation that we want to put out an RFP and give the Board of Supervisors the reason why. Most of the time it's because the existing RFP is expired or that the existing RFP didn't meet our needs. So that's what happened to the one-stop operator. There was a procurement done for an operator, but we didn't agree on what we got back in 2018. So we put out a new one. But when we did that, we still had to go in front of the Board of Supervisors and ask for permission to re-procure an operator.
Right, so then how do we make that recommendation to them, given that so far all of our service providers really haven't been hitting their metrics?
So I think this board has to make a decision. This isn't that. However, we can have those. So when we have those committee meetings, if that's what the committee wants to do, then we start the work on doing that based off of the committee's recommendation.
Yeah. Got it. Thank you so much.
So this is Mike. Yeah, I completely understand, and this is really the budget framework for planning. It's not about performance metrics for individual contracts. In fact, members of the board, there might be individual members of the board who can't vote on individual contracts depending on your level of involvement. But this is the budget framework, and the lead times, you know, make perfect sense because I had to deal with them for 20 years too. So. But it's also a good way. But there are, opportunities. If there's an unplanned grant coming in, there is a placeholder item that Karma and the team can use on the board agenda when they're really happy when money comes in. But I support this, and I'm, unless there's questions, I'm ready to move it because it is just a budget framework with the best information we have. It's not guaranteeing anything to anybody, but it's a very critical step for our planning. And again, I think the more prepared we are, the more we're going to be able to leverage and have opportunities to get additional resources. So I guess that's a motion, unless there was more questions.
I want to make two more statements because I don't want the board to feel deceived. So two things. One thing I want to highlight is when I talk about rapid response, I added something from the law about rapid response that I just want to make sure you're clear that what you're voting for. So under 20 CFR 682.340, it states that there are other uses that can be undertaken as part of rapid response. And what it says, or what I'm getting at, is that it also says that when circumstances allow, rapid response may be used to provide guidance and or financial assistance to establish community transition teams to assist the impacted community in organizing support of dislocated workers and in meeting a basic need of their families, including heat, shelter, food, clothing, and other necessities and services that are beyond the resources and ability of the one-stop delivery system to provide. I'm asking you, and I've added this to this, out of the law, to be accepted as part of our rapid response strategy for the workforce area. So my team, the Business Solutions team, will be able to provide community support as a result of anything, for example, COVID-19. My team can actually provide support to the community in response to COVID-19 or any other disaster that actually happens in the community that impacts it. So I want to highlight that. The other thing I want to highlight is that, okay, so I just told you that in order for me to renew the existing contract, I, number one, have to vote on this. But in this, it also says that you guys are giving me the ability to negotiate contracts for our existing service providers for next year. And when I negotiate those contracts, I will likely not be giving the service providers the same amount, and that the performance structure will probably stay the same. So I just want to be very transparent that you are, by voting on this, giving me that ability.
Well, a quick comment on that, Karma, regarding the performance structure, I guess the evaluation of performance. Earlier we talked about, and I think at the last meeting, we talked about the question of having the payments or the performance evaluated based on results ultimately, right? So I hear that you are asking for the ability to negotiate, but however, how do we then incorporate that potential feedback from this board to say, you know, we need a tighter way of measuring the KPI so that the contracts are performing in accordance with our intention?
That's a great question. It's kind of difficult. So I think there's two things. I think that when we do the next procurement, this board needs to decide, hey, Karma, we want to do a pay for performance structure, or we want to continue with a cost reimbursement structure. So that's what we'll evaluate as a board. In terms of the award provided to the service providers, I'm not going to deceive you. I'm going to tell you exactly how much we awarded them in May. So we have a May board meeting. So this will come up in May and say, and I'll say, this is what I'm presenting to the board supervisors as a dollar amount to give all of the service providers that are contracted with us. It may very well be where service providers may be disappointed because we reduced the contracts, but I am making decisions based off of, like I said, spending levels and performance. But that information will be presented to you at the May board meeting. And if you ever disagree with any of the recommendations or changes that I'm making, you do have the ability to take it up to the Board of Supervisors and go against what I'm voting. So in that May meeting, if the Workforce Development Board does not agree with how I'm presenting this information, this board is an advisory board to the Board of Supervisors.
Okay. Point of clarification, with the funding formula, is that outlined and compliant to law, or is that compliant to just where we see the highest and best use of funds based off previous metrics?
That is exactly right. So I had a conversation with EDD about my strategy, and they loved it because most workforce boards aren't dedicating as much money to serving people.
Okay, we're at 9 o'clock on the dot, and this is an important discussion. Having said that, are there any other questions or feedback regarding this item? Okay, hearing none, let's go ahead, and I'd like to invite someone to make a motion to approve fiscal year 2021-2022 Iowa program funding. Who would like to make
a motion?
I'll second it.
And who was the second?
Mike.
Thank you, Mike. All right, Carissa, let's go ahead and pull the board.
Okay. Gloria Alvarado?
Yes.
Natalie Alvarez?
Aye.
Jesse Benron?
Aye.
Rob Claudio?
Aye.
Eric Cordonis.
Aye.
David Hahn.
Aye.
Lori Holland-Lace.
Aye.
Trung Lee.
Aye.
John Luker.
Aye.
Annalisa Lukes.
Aye.
Doug Mangione.
Aye.
Barbara Mason. Gary Matkin. Mike Gruane.
Aye.
Todd Sword.
Aye.
And Brynjell Tumermias.
Aye.
Okay, motion carries unanimously.
Thank you so much, Carissa. Thank you, everybody, for getting us through this meeting. We're a little bit past 9 o'clock. Are there any other items that we need to discuss at this time? Okay, and do we know what the date of the next meeting is, Karma?
Carissa, can you please confirm the next school board meeting?
Yes, it is May 26th.
May 26th. Until then, thank you, everybody. Be well, and we will see you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.